Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up in 20 minutes, New York City Schools Chancellor Joel Klein. By the way, if you're following the financial situation, when we're interested in Michael Oxley there, on Monday we'll talk about gold and oil and whether they are now in a bubble and how people are rushing to 47th Street to sell their gold. So we'll talk about that on Monday. But at the Sean Bell police shooting trial yesterday, the court got to hear the grand jury testimony of Detective Giscard Esnora, the first officer to open fire. It was Esnora's emotional account of the moments leading up to his decision to shoot. And it was his version to the grand jury that ultimately indicted him, nevertheless. Joining us now with that and other developments in the case this week, New York Times correspondent Michael Wilson, who's been in the courtroom, and WNYC's Arun Venugopal, who's been in the courtroom. Welcome back, both of you, to the show. Good morning.
Good morning, Brian.
Good morning, Brian.
Reading the transcript of this, it seems as Nora was not focused on Sean Bell, but one of the passengers in his car, Joseph Guzman. Michael Wilson, why was as Nora keyed on Guzman?
Well, it all started in front of the club. Detective Esnora was waiting for a completely separate guy who's been known as the White Sox hat man, who he had seen pat a bulge in his waistband inside the club Kahlua earlier in the night. And so he thought he had a gun, so he's waiting outside for this guy to come out when he overhears Guzman say, "Go get my gun," or "Let's get my gun." As part of an argument that he and Sean Bell were having with the man popularly known as the SUV guy. Anyway, so that his attention becomes locked on on Guzman at that point, and he follows him and Sean Bell to Sean Bell's car.
And Arun, the fateful moment, the moment a cop hopes never will come, the split-second decision to fire his gun because he thinks he may get killed if he doesn't, how did Esnora describe it to the grand jury?
Well, he basically confronts the car. He's standing right in front of the car when it's in the parked position, about a foot away from it. And as he describes it, it comes at him. It knocks him out of the way, essentially. He stumbles. It hits him in the leg, backs up, and then comes back out. And that's where basically the crash happens with the car. The P van, as it's called, the minivan that another officer was driving, and at that point, it's when he's just waiting. He knows, as far as he knows, he thinks that Guzman has a gun, and that he's reaching down. He sees his hand reaching down. He's convinced he's not reaching for a seatbelt, anything like that. That he's reaching to get this gun, and he just says, "You know, I just could not wait to see what he had in the hand," and he shot before he thought it would be too late.
Michael, in your article today, you described him as panicked at that moment and then apologetic as he told the story to the grand jury. How did those emotions show themselves?
Well, it's interesting because he himself didn't open his mouth yesterday in court. His grand jury testimony was read by an employee of the Queens District Attorney's Office, a guy, you know, quite a few years older than Esnora, but still,
and just to be super clear for our listeners, this was not testimony at the trial.
No.
This is his testimony to the grand jury that indicted him being read at the trial.
Correct. So this guy reading Esnora's words, the panic kind of came through, I thought, as he describes the Sean Bell's car. He said he, quote, floored it and struck him in the leg, and then he sort of hobbled off onto the curb, and then suddenly Sean Bell's car is in reverse coming at him, and he sort of jumps out of the way, and Sean Bell's car goes forward again, and that's when he's watching Guzman's hand go into the waistband, and it's about to come out. It was all quite but he would stop and apologize. He apologized four different times for being nervous as he's speaking to the grand jurors, and he apologized a couple of times when he had to repeat a profanity that he had overheard, and then he sort of apologized in general for. He didn't say "I'm sorry about the shooting," but he said, "I never intended this to happen. I never in my career wanted to shoot my gun in the line of duty. I pray I pray for everyone who was involved that night.
So after hearing all this from Ms. Nora, Arun, the description of panic, the details of why he thought he was about to be fired on, his apologetic tone, the grand jury indicted him anyway. Is it clear to you why?
I think that there are definitely some serious questions as to why he actually undertook the actions he did. The fact is he was an undercover, and as far as he's concerned, he did hear Guzman emphatically say, "Go get my gun." So he believed that there was a gun in this very tense situation that's been described, this confrontation a few minutes earlier between Guzman and Bell and this SUV guy who we know is Fabio Kwaku, who testified a couple days ago. But the question is why, when he actually confronts him, the car that is, with Bell and Guzman, why did he do that instead of waiting for backup? There were other officers all over the place. His commanding officer's car was very close by. In fact, it passed them just as all of this started playing out. And so that seemed to be really perhaps the mistake that he made, is instead of waiting for people to come and to surround the car, anything like that, he went ahead and took matters into his own hands. And as far as he was concerned, he was alone at that scene. And he was also, I think, apparently he was very nervous, not just on the stand, but even his state of mind that night seemed to be that he was very antsy inside the club, and very nervous when he came out. And as we just described, when waiting for that gun, he was just so convinced it was there. And as we know, it wasn't there. There was no gun inside that car.
Did the prosecution, Arun, offer an alternative story as to what Joseph Guzman might have been doing, reaching into his waistband repeatedly, if they acknowledge that he was?
It didn't really play out, since we were simply hearing the grand jury testimony read out from a year ago. You did hear a grand juror say something to the effect of, "Well, are you sure he wasn't just reaching for his seatbelt, something like that?" Mm-hmm. And he said no, he wasn't. He was very clear on that point. He was also convinced that he said, "I had eye contact with both these men. They were looking at me. I was looking at them. I'm quite sure they could see my shield," which he said he had put on just a few moments before as he was turning the corner onto this street. So, and he said he was screaming, basically identifying that he's police, "Don't move, basically show me your hands, don't move." He was convinced that they could hear him. Again, of course, what the grand jury raises is, are you sure they could hear you? I mean, their windows were closed. So these are some of the doubts, I think, as to why he really took control of the situation, whether they, for instance, either couldn't hear him say that he was police, or that they thought he was perhaps the SUV guy who they presumably thought had a gun and maybe was confronting him. So it could have been a very confusing situation where he really did not establish clearly who he was.
WNYC's Arun Venugopal and New York Times correspondent Michael Wilson with me on WNYC, both covering the Sean Bell, Bell trial. Michael, backing up a little bit, Isnora was an undercover cop, but he says he approached the car with his badge on his collar and shouting, "Police." Whether he really was identifying himself, that clearly remains a question in the case. But did he say in this grand jury testimony transcript why he decided to blow his cover, something undercover cops are supposed to do only under extreme circumstances?
Well, that said, you almost answered your own question. He felt it was an extreme circumstance. He thought that a shooting was imminent in his testimony. I mean, he believes that Guzman is going to get a gun and use it. So he follows him to the car. While he's walking, he puts the shield on his collar but keeps his hand over it as he passes other kind of people on the sidewalk, so that only at the last moment, when he gets closer to the car, does he put the hand away from his shield and yell, "Police, don't move."
And why did he even run toward the car? There had been this argument between Bell and the man in black, Mr. Kwaku, who testified Wednesday, who supposedly had a gun. But Kwaku had driven away. Why did Isnora then go running after Sean Bell and his friends?
Well, because I guess he thought he was following the men who were going to get a gun.
Right, because he testified that he heard them say they were going to get a gun.
Right.
Now, the transcript shows that the grand jurors asked Detective Asnora follow-up questions after his account, like why he kept firing if no one was firing back, and why he didn't take cover if he thought he might be shot at rather than shooting at the car. What were his responses, Michael, to that?
They did ask several questions, and those were, you know, in a way, sort of good questions. They've been questions that everyone's been asking. They asked, why did you keep firing when no one else was firing back at you? He did fire 11 shots, and he said, it all happened so quickly. I didn't know. It was over in a matter of seconds. And they asked, why didn't you run for cover? And he said, there was no cover. If there was cover to be taken, I would have taken it, he said. I had the wall behind me. It was like a wide open space. Where else could I go?
Arun, anything to add to that?
Well, as some of the lawyers who represent the victims were saying yesterday, well, there were actually several cars out there on the street. So I think that it did happen so fast that he didn't really feel that he had the time to wait for possibly for Guzman, Guzman as he calls himself, to step out of the car and start shooting him. But yeah, it just happened way too fast for him to think he could really deliberate further.
Now, Arun, this is another instance of the prosecution introducing evidence that the defense might have been expected to present, the defendant's side of the story from his grand jury testimony. Did the prosecutor actively try to discredit it in any way?
The prosecutor? Did he try to discredit Asnora?
Correct.
Well, no. I mean, basically, all you heard was this recitation of the grand jury testimony. And so we could hear the prosecutor interjecting occasionally, but he did not aggressively question him. He was just trying to get the narrative out. There were a couple times where he asked him, some follow-up questions, but it was by no means was he trying to discredit him.
Right. And I don't mean so much in the grand jury testimony, but yesterday, in the presentation in the trial of this grand jury transcript, was the prosecutor being aggressive? Was the prosecutor framing this in a certain way so that Asnora's side of the story didn't just sit out there?
No, I think that he wanted to just kind of put it out there. Basically, all you really heard was the prosecutor and this man from the DA's office who was reading Asnora's account. They were essentially doing this the reading together. So you would have basically the prosecutor, Charles Descarosa, reading his parts from last year, and then this person from the DA's office who was reading Isnora's part. So they were just kind of going back and forth. It was sort of a rote kind of a recitation.
So, Michael, what did the defense do yesterday?
No, nothing. They didn't. You can't cross-examine a transcript, so they didn't.
Right.
They just sat there.
So this was just a presentation of evidence by reading this into the record.
Right. It was sort of put in there without any comment, and as was Detective Cooper's earlier in the week.
And so what's the strategy behind pulling this out and introducing it without comment that way, Michael? This might be another case where people question whether the prosecution is presenting the defense's case.
I think it's just going. It just the prosecution seems to be, you know, erring on the side of putting more in. More is more, almost. They are putting everything that they know about the shooting of Sean Bell into the public record. So at the end of the day, they can say everything that is known about this case, we present it. I think you still are going to hear Asnora in person testify. That seems to be the feeling in the courtroom, as well as some of the other detectives, about what did happen that night.
And bottom line, what will the prosecution have to show based on this description of events that we've just been picking apart? What will they have to show to convince the judge that Asnora committed a crime in opening fire on Sean Bell and his friends rather than a mistake?
That, you know, they'd have to show just a depravity for human life, almost, on Asnora's part. To prove manslaughter, he has to this willingness to take a human life with a sort of disregard. And then the lesser charge, reckless endangerment, that he acted, you know, with criminal recklessness in what he did.
So they will have to spin Isnora's version of events, where he's describing himself in this transcript as panicked and not at all wanting. He says, the last thing, you've got the quote, it's the last thing I ever wanted to do. You know, how fearful he was at the moment that he was about to be shot. They're going to have to convince the judge that somehow that all translated to a depraved indifference to human life.
Yes, like the whole focusing on Guzman's hand, like that it was a criminal error on Isnora's part to not wait another second and a half to see what was in that hand.
So we just have 30 seconds left. Arun, has the prosecution started to set up the argument for that in opening arguments or anything?
I think that they have, that with this testimony, with this grand jury reading, that they have, I think, pretty effectively shown that there were some serious, very questionable actions taken that night on the part of Isnora and his part in the larger operation, that there was just very poor coordination. As far as whether, I mean, I think he actually appeared fairly sympathetic from whatever you can read into, you know, the recitation of his testimony. But I do think at the same time he it looked like he, you know, he was operating on his own very much at that moment, that he made some very questionable moves, and that there was very little intelligence or information shared between the various officers. To that extent, I think they've taken some steps forward.
As we continue to cover the Sean Bell trial, WNYC's Arun Venugopal, New York Times correspondent Michael Wilson, thank you both very much for taking time out from the courtroom.
Thank you, Brian.
Thank you, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, New York City Schools Chancellor Joel Klein next. Stay with us.